Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
They haven't really explained and they haven't been transparent enough about what is the overall strategy, what's the future. You know, okay, we might get sort of an observer status at the UN, but what next? What are we going to use this for?
Frank Barat joins us to discuss the arrival of Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in New York as Abbas tries to see his promise through to obtain statehood for Palestine. Frank Barat focuses on human rights in the context of the Israeli occupation. He's coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. And even before news arrived in New York of the arrival of Abbas, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made an effort to get in ahead of the morning headlines in America with a sudden offer to negotiate. Hussam Zamlat is a member of the Palestinian official delegation to the United Nations.
This press release that has come out of the Israeli Prime Minister office has all the making of a propaganda campaign. Apparently, again, Mr. Netanyahu is engaged in the blame game. Nothing substantive is coming out of him and his government.
Al Jazeera English also offering a clip of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
No matter what does or doesn't happen this week, it will not produce the kind of outcome that everyone is hoping for. So we're going to stay very much engaged and focused.
Another concern for Israel and America is the potential for Palestinians to join the International Criminal Court if they obtain statehood at the UN. We'll also hear from law professor John Quigley about the ICC and Turkey's case against Israel over the Mavi Marmara killings. Frank Barat is author with Noam Chomsky and Ian Papp of Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. He also has a new book coming out about the London session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, which is set to open in Cape Town, South Africa's District 6 Museum on November 5th. There will be opening remarks from Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu. Frank Barat, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Doris. Thanks for having me.
As Mahmoud Abbas arrives in New York on the 20th, as we speak, Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel offering negotiations, the Palestinians responding immediately, okay, stop settlement building, but also some calling it propaganda. Why don't you respond first to that development, because we've not seen any movement toward, you know, meaningful talks in quite a while. The Secretary of State's office, however, responding immediately to this offer from Netanyahu.
I mean, obviously, we still don't know after more than 20 years of negotiations what negotiations means in the head of the Israeli government. Actually, if we look at the facts, we know what negotiation means for the Israelis. When you look at the fact over the last 20 years, negotiations and negotiating with the Palestinians means more settlement building, more attacks on Gaza, more extrajudicial killings, more land grabs. So negotiation is everything but negotiation. And anyway, when you are dealing with an oppressor and an oppressed people, and when the oppressor, in this case Israel, is supported by the only sort of remaining superpower, the USA, negotiation can't happen on sort of an equal basis. So yeah, this is the last call, like today, by Netanyahu, and I think the UN ambassador, Israeli ambassador in the UN, Ron Prosser, saying that, you know, we're ready to start negotiating again, is a nothing really, is a non-event, and is a just blatant propaganda, because then they're going to use this against Palestine. I think, look, you know, to the world, we were once again ready to negotiate, but they chose to go to the UN instead. So yeah, this is a sort of propaganda move, something by Israel.
This having now gone on for 60 years, you know, I was in college when the discussion centered on recognition of Israel by the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, the big word that went on for years of debate over whether or not recognition was, first of all, going to happen, then whether or not the words were sufficient, then whether or not it was meaningful, then how to enforce it, you know. And then, of course, what we were discussing in 2008 is a UN forum which found Israel culpable of systematically violating Palestinian human rights. This really putting Western countries in one court and people backing the Palestinians in another. you know, also pointing up sides having to do with Syria, Egypt, and Iran. And so now we've seen since then this development, this drama that's been unfolding of the Arab Spring. And so we're looking at a change in the world having come after what has appeared to be the West's simple tying of their own hands, if you will, on doing anything meaningful to stop violations of human rights in this one instance of Palestinians. So just comment on that history, Frank Berhot, and tell us what you think now about the context for this and what it means.
The first one about recognition, it's very important to say that the Palestinians have recognized Israel many times in the past, and actually have done a lot more than this. In 1993, for the Oslo Accords, the Palestinians recognized not Israel as a state, but recognized Israel's right to exist, which is a very strong formulation. It's the first time in history that a state doesn't only recognize another state, it recognizes the state's right to exist. So it's a very strong formulation that was asked by the Israelis and that the Palestinians have accepted. And since then, the Israeli government has always asked the Palestinians to recognize Israel again and to recognize it as such or such or such a state. And the latest demand, which is a very new demand by Netanyahu, is asking the Palestinians to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. You know, I won't go into it for too long because it's quite a long explanation, but which is obviously unacceptable for the Palestinians and should be unacceptable for anyone, you know, that cares about human rights in the world. The state shouldn't be based on ethnicity. The state should be based on democracy and the right to vote for all its citizens, etc. So yeah, the Israelis have always, you know, tried to put more and more demands on the back of the Palestinians while refusing to ever recognize a Palestinian state. So it's a really Orwellian situation where, for, you know, the first time in history, I think an oppressed people keep sort of recognizing its oppressor, with the oppressor not deeming to recognize the right of the oppressed, and the world sort of following suit. That's the first point. You also talked about the Arab Spring, and I think it's a crucial point and crucial aspect in this story, because I think that the Palestinian Authority is also going to the UN because it has realized that the Arab Spring was going to come at one point to Palestine, and that the Palestinian people are sick of 20 years of settlement building, of, you know, assassination, bombing, etc. And they're sick of sort of PA or the Palestinian Authority seemingly compromising with Israel all the time without sort of taking a very strong stand. So I think the move to the UN for recognition was also a move by the PA saying, look, we need to react now, otherwise our people are going to turn against us. That's one point. And where are we now? I mean, the move to go to the UN has been strongly criticized by Palestinians, you know, from the occupied territories, from the diaspora, from refugee camps, because they're asking, is the PA really representing us, and is it the right move at the right time? So that's another long sort of longing question. But what can happen now? I mean, the PA has decided to go for full membership at the UN, which wasn't sort of clear from the start. So they are going to go on Friday to the Security Council. I mean, they might go on to the Security Council because now they're facing so much pressure. You know, I think we never know. You know, on Friday morning, they might decide not to. So they'll go to the Security Council. They need 9 votes to be recognized as a state. Actually, they need 10 votes. But if they get 9 votes, it means the U.S. will have to veto it because the U.S. clearly said we will veto such a move. And the U.S. obviously doesn't want to veto the move. So the U.S. hopes that they won't get the 9 votes required for this, and the 9 votes will sort of make a U.S. veto an obligation. So then, I mean, the U.S., the full recognition of Palestine is going to fail anyway because the U.S. is going to veto the move. But I think by going to the Security Council, the Palestinian Authority wants to put pressure on the U.S. and to show the world that, you know, the U.S. is not an honest broker in this story. So then they will probably go to the UN General Assembly, where they need a 2-3 majority to be granted an observer status at the UN. That should happen. But then what happened next? I mean, that's what hasn't really been clear for many Palestinians and from the PA. I think, you know, they haven't really explained and they haven't been transparent enough about what is the overall strategy, what's the future. you know, okay, we might get sort of an observer status at the UN, but what next? What are we going to use this for? So, yeah, there's, I think, lots of questions have remained unanswered.
This is the start of this discussion about Palestinian statehood at the UN level in New York, and yet the United States has already said they will veto it, in effect saying that, you know, there's no point trying to negate it before it even starts. And meanwhile, in Israel, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has said Israelis are now, you know, informing Palestinian leaders in a threatening way that they can expect grave consequences. This morning, BBC, one of their headlines, you know, as Israel considers, you know, worsening conditions for Palestinians.
We can't sort of predict the future, but the development in Israel and your occupied territories, it looks like the backlash on the Palestinian after the UN vote could be quite drastic. I mean, Israel is trying to scare the Palestinian Authority in going to the UN by saying, look, if you go to the UN, I mean, lots of rumors have circulated, such as, we will arm the settlers. You know, they're already armed anyway, but we will train and arm the settlers even more. You know, they'd be ready to attack Palestinians, and because we're not sure what to expect, but something that could happen is that the Palestinian people, after the UN vote, if Palestine is recognized as an observer of status in the UN General Assembly, you know, Palestinian civil society could get together and start walking towards a settlement, saying, look, we've got sort of a half a state recognition in the UN, you are an illegal settlement, you need to go. So lots of demonstration could happen all over the place, and how Israel is going to react to those demonstrations. I mean, we know for the last 60 years that any time the Palestinians demonstrate, they get shot at, first by tear gas, then, you know, rubber-coated metal bullets, and then live ammunition. I mean, that's a so-called democracy acting this way, and no one ever condemns it. So, yeah, it could get very violent and very scary for the Palestinian people, but I think they've been used to this for 60 years, and they're ready to continue the struggle in spite of the violence from Israel.
And I should also say, Frank Berat, that, you know, even as this discussion was underway a few days ago, the Congress and Democrats and Republicans coming together on this one, Steny Hoyer of Maryland, Republican Eric Cantor of Virginia, introducing a quote-unquote non-binding resolution, you know, with hundreds of signatures, and it would strip the Palestinian Authority of $600 million in aid payments that it receives from the U.S. government, you know, if they go to the U.N. for statehood. How extraordinary is just that one point that is happening now in response to this?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is not extraordinary, because it happens all the time with the U.S., so, you know, they always back Israel. But if you look at the grander scheme of things, this is extraordinary. You know, we are talking about an occupied people, an oppressed people, the people in Gaza that are living in very bad sort of humanitarian conditions. And you've got the biggest state, the most powerful state in the world, that tells these people that, you know, if they seek, you know, recognition as a people and as a state, or, you know, the right to self-determination is an inalienable right. You know, every people has the right to self-determination. And they are telling those oppressed people, if you are trying or making such a move, which is a legal move under the UN Charter and every other charter you can imagine, such as the Geneva Conventions, etc., we will punish you. So this is extraordinary. And I think that the people, you know, U.S. citizens should realize how extraordinary this is. You know, it's very difficult to find another example in history of such a thing.
Well, one thing that we could bring up, and I know you have the Russell Tribunal on Palestine coming up soon in South Africa, and, you know, we could look at the crime of apartheid and, you know, ask whether or not that's applicable to Israel and what, if any, consequences there should have been. And of course, you, Frank Berat, author of a new book, Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians, you know, Gaza too. I mean, still not really any answer from the world as to what happened there.
And that's what we're going to look at in November in South Africa, in Cape Town. We're not going to compare apartheid South Africa and Israel possible apartheid, because people often mistakenly think that apartheid equals South Africa apartheid, but apartheid in 1973 was deemed a crime against humanity, and there was a convention for the repression and suppression of the crime of apartheid, which is applicable to countries all over the world. So we're just simply going to take this convention and try to see if it can, you know, if it's applicable to Israel. So point by point, we're going to have experts and witnesses coming from all over the world, so legal experts and also people from the ground, that are going to tell us the story. And we're going to have a jury jury panel listening to them, and at the end of 2 or 3 days of testimonies, issuing a sort of a verdict, you know, looking at, is Israel guilty of the crime of apartheid in the occupied Palestinian territories, but also, you know, against the Palestinian people as a whole, so Palestinians living in refugee camps, in diaspora, and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And legally, if the crime of apartheid, if a state has been recognized as guilty of the crime of apartheid, the international community and third parties have a duty to intervene. It's like when the word genocide is mentioned in a UN resolution or something, other states have the duty to intervene. So then we as people, you know, as human rights activists, we'll be able to go to the EU Commission, the EU Parliament, and different parliaments around Europe and the world, saying this really in-depth study proves that Israel is guilty of the crime of apartheid, which is racial domination of one people on another. You now need to intervene. It will also enable campaigns around the world to have a very strong legal argument on their side as well.
The question has been raised again of building permits for Palestinians versus others. And I think that also points up the differences here in terms of racial questions. Those who may be settlers or Israelis trying to move into East Jerusalem, into land recently taken, you know, houses recently bulldozed and new construction that is illegal and ongoing and opposed by America. There is a difference, isn't there? If you're on the West Bank or if you're in East Jerusalem, you can't build if you're a Palestinian, even if you have a building permit, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, again, it was a symbol of apartheid under South Africa apartheid, and the Israeli Jews and the Palestinians, being citizens of Israel or not, have completely different rights. For a Palestinian to build a house in area A, B, or C is pretty much impossible. I mean, when you're in area B, which is under normally half Palestinian, half Israeli control, or area C, which is pretty much under full Israeli control, it's pretty much impossible. You know, people that I know personally, Salim Shawarem from Anata, has asked and 4 or 5 times for a building permit. And a building permit costs money as well. So every time you go, you give money, you bring all the documents necessary, etc., and you ask for a building permit. And then you wait and wait and wait. It's also, you know, the Israeli occupation, we can't forget that it's also a bureaucratic occupation. You know, everything to get a visa, to get a housing permit, take months and months and months. So people end up building anyway because it's their land, their space, they've got, you know, building materials, so they build. And then their house gets destroyed again and again and again. There's been no, for example, no new Palestinian city or Arab cities in Israel for about, you know, since Israel creation, probably, you know, meaning like, what, 63 years ago now. And there's been loads of new Israeli cities, loads of new Israeli colonies in the West Bank, etc. So the situation is very, very different if you are a Jewish citizen of Israel or a Palestinian citizen of Israel. To conclude, I really think that regardless of what happens at the UN, I think, you know, the Palestinian struggle is before anything a people struggle. And I think more and more people, and you saw it with the Arab Spring, have very little faith in their government. And we can only hope that people around the world, we're not talking only about the Middle East, because we've got our own problems in Europe and in the US, and we've seen the last few days, I think, on Wall Street, people demonstrating and occupying Wall Street, which is an amazing move, I think. So we can only hope that this continues and this gets bigger and bigger, because this is sort of a global struggle, I think. It's not only about Palestine or about the Middle East. It's about, you know, the type of world we want to live in. So, yeah, hopefully something will happen. The people will realize slowly that they need to uprise, really, against those injustices all over the world.
Frank Barat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Frank Barat is author with Noam Chomsky and Ian Papp of Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. He's coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, a people's tribunal set up in the spirit of the Tribunal on Vietnam, created by Bertrand Russell in the 1960s. The next session begins in Cape Town, South Africa, in November. There's been an explosion at a busy downtown section of Ankara, Turkey, on the morning of September 20th. It killed 3 people and wounded 34, the blast later turning out to be the result of a car bomb. One person arrested at the scene after it was reported she called out something that seemed political. You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dory Smith. U.S. President Barack Obama offering personal condolences to Prime Minister Erdogan and the Turkish people. When they were at the UN, he also thanked Erdogan for promoting democracy and for Turkey's agreement to host a missile defense radar system he said benefits NATO. Professor John Quigley of Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law joins us next to talk about Turkey's efforts to bring Israel to the ICC, International Criminal Court. He's author of many books and publications, including Palestine and Israel, A Challenge to Justice. Professor, welcome.
Very good. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, we've been looking at the arrival of Mahmoud Abbas in New York on his bid for statehood for Palestine. But meanwhile, in Turkey, Prime Minister Recep Erdogan discussing bringing Israel to the ICC. But I've been reading calls for Turkey to join the ICC. Do they have to be a member first?
Well, actually, Turkey doesn't have to become a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court. The court has jurisdiction in ways that are specified in its statute, one of which is that it has jurisdiction over an act that occurs on board a vessel of a state where the state is a party to the statute. The Mavi Marmara, which is the vessel in question, the vessel on which the death occurred in June of 2010, that vessel was Turkish-owned, but it was reflagged shortly before the voyage in Comoros Islands. Comoros Islands is a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court. That means that the court has jurisdiction. So it isn't really necessary for Turkey to be a party for the court to have jurisdiction. As I understand, the plan is that the matter will be taken to the ICC, not by Turkey as a state, but by the non-governmental organization that was primary in organizing the voyage of that particular vessel.
And what would that mean? I know right now the Israelis are under somewhat increased pressure, partly in the region where they are because of the so-called Arab Spring, but also because of this request that Abbas is making. Some are calling it politics and saying that he may well give up more land than would otherwise have happened after negotiations that could occur in the wake of any appeal for statehood. But be that as it may, I mean, we're looking at a situation where Israel is under perhaps more pressure. What's your interpretation of events and what might or, you know, could unfold?
Well, certainly this action with respect to the Turkish ship would put pressure on Israel, but much more could come out of the efforts of the Palestinian government. That could potentially lead to additional prosecution at the International Criminal Court, either for war crimes during the Gaza War of 2008-2009, or it could even lead to prosecution for the construction of settlements in the West Bank, because that's defined as a war crime. And if Palestine is definitely regarded as a state by the ICC, then the ICC would have jurisdiction, because Palestine has sent the ICC a letter confirming jurisdiction on the court, and if Palestine is regarded as a state, then that would be a valid confirmation of jurisdiction. There may be other ways as well in which pressure is going to be brought to bear on Israel. Palestine will be able to participate in a wide variety of treaties the Palestine government has been concerned with the deterioration of some of the sites in the city of Bethlehem, and they're trying to get that to be declared a protected zone under treaties that come under UNESCO, the UN Economic, Social, and Cultural Organization. But that, too, depends on Palestine being a state.
And we saw an explosion in Turkey September 20th, and I wondered, do you foresee complications of that kind within Turkish borders as a result? I mean, we definitely have seen the Israeli government, and especially under Netanyahu, but more specifically, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, openly threatening the Palestinians with retaliation and grave consequences if they do go to the UN. They are going to the UN. What about Turkey? Could they see themselves or find themselves also threatened?
I suppose that could happen. It remains to be seen what kind of action Israel might take. There's nothing I can see that would be lawful, but one of the things that's been suggested is that Israel might withhold customs money that it collects. Since it controls the borders, it collects customs money that's due to Palestine and hands it over. And it's threatened to not hand it over, you know, which would be illegal, but which would then, you know, create another kind of crisis for the UN to deal with.
And two, I mean, you mentioned that issue of money. There is an ongoing attempt at boycott, divestment, and sanctions globally. And I wondered, you know, could Israel apply some form of pressure to corporations doing business, perhaps, between the two countries, or in some other way apply pressure that would affect the economy of Turkey?
Yes, I suppose Israel could try that. I think it might have some difficulty getting very far with it, because there are so many countries involved that Israel is not on good terms with. So I think it might have difficulty getting corporations to agree to certain, you know, conditions of non-cooperation with the countries with which Israel is at odds.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, Professor Quigley, because I know that the United States has been stepping up its sort of relationship with the Israelis in terms of corporate crossover, you know, companies doing business in America and also Tel Aviv. So interesting that you say that. What about this question, though, of where we stand now? I mean, do you think that Israel could in fact now be pressured in ways that couldn't happen before the so-called Arab Spring started?
Well, I think so. I think it's quite clear that through the Arab world, the sentiment is much different than what it was, or to put it another way, the sentiment has been able to come out, and that Israel is not going to be able to count on such good relations as it has been able to have in recent years with the Arab states.
Can you just comment finally on anything further in more detail that the ICC could look at in relation to Turkey as they talk about what the Israelis are doing in the world, and perhaps settlements as an example?
Yes, well, I mean, I don't see anything in relation to Turkey at the ICC beyond the Mavi Marmara, but the fact that the ICC statute makes the construction of settlements a war crime, you know, opens up a very broad possible range of investigation and prosecution that could include Israeli officials across the board. And I think that's one of the things the Israeli government is concerned about in all that's going on now at the UN.
Law Professor John Quigley of Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He's author of Palestine and Israel, A Challenge to Justice. Professor Quigley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our theme song is by Fritz Heed.